Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my great pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Andy Jamieson, Professor Emeritus of History at Harvard, former Vice Chancellor of UC Berkeley, and the Librarian of the Bohemian Club, and a member of one of the units that fought in the Battle of the Bulge. I don't think you can have too many people with those qualifications speak in front of you often, and it's my great pleasure, I've heard him speak on many occasions, to ask Andy to speak on this topic, which is dear to his heart. Thank you.
Thank you, George. On December the 16th, 1944, the Germans launched a massive campaign against the American front in the Ardennes Forest on the German-Belgian border. And in a single day, German panzer and infantry divisions overwhelmed U.S. defenses along the 45-mile line. Hitler's troops were bedded by one of the coldest winters of deep snows ever recorded in the region, and the American army was completely unprepared, the result of a gross failure of intelligence. Hitler planned the Ardennes campaign, codenamed Watch on the Rhine, as a turning point of the war in the West. By Christmas Eve, the Germans had advanced 65 miles, creating a bulge in the Allied lines, which gave the battle its name. Three German armies of 250,000 troops and almost 1,000 tanks and assault guns smashed through the American defenses, disintegrating the front lines. And it was not until January the 25th, 1945, that the Allied command was able to push the Germans back to their German frontier and erase the bulge. The Ardennes is an ancient northern European forest, about 80 miles in length. It is an isolated, forested, hilly terrain which extends westward across Belgium from the German border to the Meuse River and the border of France. And here is a lone GI in the forest before the coming of the winter snows. But during the winter, it consists of freezing rain, stinging sleet, and blankets of fresh snow, which at times are whipped by blizzard winds which make any movement by man or machine extremely difficult. The short wintry days are engulfed by heavy fog and an eternal grayness which creates a sense of gloom. And for the most of the next several weeks, GIs of infantry units will spend much of their days inching forward, low on their stomachs, sneaking through the snow as German machine guns sprayed the fields. The Ardennes sector of the Western Front was known to the Allied soldiers as the Ghost Front. The major roads through the forest are paved, but many of the secondary roads are narrow dirt tracks which meander through the mountains. The Ardennes offensive was the brainchild of Adolf Hitler. In a conversation with Chief of the Army Albert Jodl, Jodl referred to the Ardennes region as the weakest point of the Allied front along the Belgian-Luxembourg border with Germany. He told Hitler that only four American divisions were holding the front along the Ardennes. And Hitler identified the Ardennes with the successful panzer drive across the mountains to the Meuse River, which led to the fall of France in 1940 at the beginning of World War II. Hitler reasoned that the alliance between the United States and Britain was weak and fragile, and that the Allies could be split by a German offensive across the Ardennes to the Meuse River, and then by a German drive northwest to the port of Antwerp, which was the major American supply port. By December 1944, the Allies were not far from the borders of Nazi Germany and the Rhine River. Hitler then conceived of Operation Autumn Mist, which was a code name for the general Ardennes offensive, watch on the Rhine. And he planned the campaign on two of the principles of war, on secrecy and speed, to assemble a massive force on the border without alerting Allied intelligence, and then to reach the Meuse River within 4 days before the Allies began to shift their forces to contain the northern and southern flanks of the Bulge, with its tip pointing to the Meuse River bridges near Liège. The Allied High Command did not expect an attack through the Ardennes. In fact, a Scheiff intelligence summary, and Scheiff is an acronym for Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, a Scheiff intelligence summary of December 16 reported, quote, "The enemy is at present fighting a defensive campaign on all fronts. His situation is such that he cannot stage major offensive operations," unquote. But the Germans were able secretly to amass an invasion force of two large panzer armies, and if discovered, the Germans thought that the Allies would consider it as a German defense force to protect the area around Aachen and Cologne against the Allied invasion of Germany. So moving by night, the Germans spread straw on the roads to muffle their movement, and they sent fighters low over the American lines to drown out the sound of the thousands of tanks and vehicles assembled for the offensive. The start of the operation was also planned to take advantage of the weather. December 16 was a bitter, cold, misty morning with 6 inches of snow on the ground, and the sun was hidden as it would be for the coming week. To assure the success of the Ardennes offensive, Hitler assigned all available German forces and materiel, tanks and infantry units, which were not needed on the Eastern Front against the Russians. Three armies were scheduled to participate in the offensive: the 6th Panzer Army in the north, the 5th Panzer Army in the center, and the 7th Infantry Army on the south. The 6th Panzer Army was under the command of SS General Joseph Sepp Dietrich in the north, the 5th Panzer Army under the command of General Hasse von Manteuffel in the center of the Bulge, and the weak 7th Infantry Army in the south to protect the southern flank of the offensive against any American counterattacks from the south. The American armies, which were destined to fight the Battle of the Bulge, were under the command of General Omar Bradley's 12th Army Group, and they included Lieutenant General William Simpson's 9th Army in the north, Lieutenant General Courtney Hodges' 1st Army in the center, and Lieutenant General Patton's 3rd Army in the south. So from north to south, the three American armies were deployed from Holland and along the German-Belgian border to Luxembourg, and then along the German border to the Saar River. And here is Bradley on the left, Eisenhower and Patton. The forested terrain of the Ardennes is situated in the center of this long frontier. It was the Ghost Front, and it was commanded by Major General Troy Middleton. His 8th Corps, which was assigned to prepare for the coming offensive against the Rhine. And it was regarded to be strategically unsuitable for any military operation, both on the ground and in the air, especially during the extreme winter conditions. For this reason, the Ghost Front of the Ardennes was held by 4 or 5 understaffed and widely dispersed green U.S. divisions. The veteran divisions of the 1st and 9th Armies, which had fought across France and Belgium and Holland, were taken off the line for rest and rehabilitation after the bloody campaigns of the Ruhr and Hürtgen Forest. In the south, Patton's 3rd Army was deployed along the Saar region opposite the Siegfried Line. And Patton was preparing for an offensive against the highly fortified line with Frankfurt as his objective, and this was scheduled for December 19. But Hitler's Ardennes offensive intervened on December 16. A senior staff meeting of Army Group commanders, which included Bradley's 12th American Army Group and Montgomery's 21st British Army Group met with Allied General Eisenhower at Maastricht in the Dutch Panhandle on December 7 to discuss the coming Rhine campaign. Montgomery pressed for a narrow, focused, and restricted campaign in the Ruhr Valley by his 21st Army Group in the north, while Eisenhower favored a broader strategic plan by crossing the Rhine River. The participants at the meeting took note of the buildup of Germany's 6th Panzer Army, which was being deployed along the German frontier of the Ardennes, but the German panzers were thought to be in the area for the defense of the Rhine and for the defense of Cologne, the regions of Germany. The senior Allied commanders disregarded the Third Army's G2 report of the German buildup. Patton had passed the intelligence about the 6th Panzer Army onto Eisenhower's G2, which informed Bradley's 1st Army G2. But Bradley and his senior staff were convinced that a German offensive through the Ardennes was highly impracticable and even foolhardy. They considered the German buildup as a defense of the Rhine against any Allied operation aimed at the German homeland. Bradley's comment later was, "Where in hell has the son of a bitch gotten all his strength?" By their failure to read the intelligence and to anticipate the offensive, Eisenhower and Bradley lost confidence in their leadership. Eisenhower was then persuaded to place the U.S. 1st Army and the U.S. 9th Army under Montgomery's British command in the northern sector, while Montgomery kept embarrassing the Allied command by his tactless remarks, which tended to downplay the American contribution in the battle by exaggerating his own part. And when he continued to press for his appointment as Supreme Land Commander with Bradley's American 12th Army Group under his own British 21st Army Group, Eisenhower threatened to ask for his resignation. But Montgomery withdrew his command, his demand. The German strategy for the offensive called for the three armies to be deployed along a 37-mile front with the heaviest units in the north on the right flank, spearheaded by units of Dietrich's 6th Panzer Army. And this northern front afforded the shortest distance and the most direct route to the river and the French border. It included 60% of all available German armor for the offensive. In the center of the front, von Manteuffel's 5th Panzer Army, its mission was to protect the left flank of the 6th Panzer Army's thrust in the north. The south front was assigned to the German 7th Army, which had practically no armor. Its mission was to protect the southern flank of the Bulge against a possible American thrust northward, i.e. by Patton's 3rd Army. When Hitler proposed the offensive, most senior German army officers doubted the success of the strategy. But their concern was not brought to Hitler's attention because, as Field Marshal von Rundstedt later remarked, he knew that Hitler would reject it. And von Rundstedt later said, "It was obvious to me that the available forces were far too small. In fact, no soldier really believed that the aim of reaching Antwerp was really practicable. But I knew by now that it was useless to protest to Hitler about the possibility of anything." The German offensive began with a massive pre-dawn artillery barrage on December 16. This was the heaviest bombardment that even veterans had experienced. Out of the morning darkness came German shock troops, followed closely by columns of tanks, powerful panzer and panzer grenadier units, many of them bearing the jagged double SS. Here's a Tiger II tank. Here's a Tiger with American POWs on their way to captivity. Here is a Tiger II. The Tiger II was the most powerful tank of the war, much more powerful than the Americans. Here's an example of difference between the Tiger on the left and the Sherman on the right. And this German Tiger, a powerful tank, was built to counter any future Soviet tank, but it was difficult to maneuver on the Ardennes battlefield, which limited its effectiveness and its force. And here, GIs inspect a knocked-out German King Tiger. Here is a knocked-out Panther. Here, a German tank which slid into the ditch. And by the way, the Ardennes is known as the cemetery of the tanks because all these monsters had to do was slip 2 inches from the road into a gully and they were dead. And here are knocked out Sherman tanks on a battlefield. And this Sherman tank tries to move in heavy snow. The Germans overran and annihilated 2 weak U.S. divisions online. And American commanders were then forced to use small, dispersed units, which managed to escape capture, and then to conduct a gradual slow-motion retreat in the face of the advancing Germans on both the St. Vith salient in the north and the Bastogne salient in the center. But in the process, U.S. units suffered very heavy casualties as they were pushed back from roadblock to roadblock and from village to village. The German advance was also harassed by American small unit firepower, rifle power, BAR, mortar, machine gun, and bazooka power. Here is an American bazooka team. Here a GI carries a Thompson submachine gun. Here is a mortar section of an infantry company. Here is a GI with a Browning automatic. And here is a GI carrying the M1 Garand, the baby of the American arsenal, but a baby which was very, very accurate. And then whatever military was available. And here are GIs with their M1s going into battle. And whatever artillery was available was brought into play, like this 105 howitzer. In the north, U.S. units were able to stop the German advance by defending the main roadblocks and the Royal Rail Junction of St. Vith, thus preventing the Germans from sending reinforcements and supplies, especially gasoline, to their spearhead units, a few of which had reached the vicinity of the Meuse River by breaking through a center gap above Bastogne. In the center of the bulge, von Manteuffel's 5th Panzer Army did break through the American defense and overwhelmed 2 regiments of the newly arrived 106th Infantry. This was the largest mass surrender of U.S. troops in Europe in the war. The annihilation of the 106th opened the gap through which German units then continued their advance to the Meuse River objective, where they were forced to await fuel and supplies. But the gap through the American lines was not complete because U.S. units were able to defend with dogged determination, with very, very heavy losses, the crossroads which led to the town of Bastogne. The German units which opened the gap were forced to bypass the town. Here is a fog-shrouded infantry column on the march. Here, GIs in snow seek cover in a forest. Here, GIs dug in poorly defensive positions. The hard ground was difficult to break into, and GIs were left exposed to German artillery and mortar attack. GIs dig in while under fire, and the soldier in the foreground has just been killed. GIs here passing a German tank on their way to captivity. American POWs trekking into captivity, a long trek to prison camps, Many died on the way with little food. Some tried to escape, but few succeeded. And here is a young POW, obviously in shock. And here an American column passes in retreat through a battered village. And this was a very common scene across the Ardennes with muddy ground and dull, cold weather. And here a U.S. M10 tank destroyer tries to negotiate a muddy road. Here is the most prominent, most powerful weapon, the German 88. The 88 was called Screaming Mimes by the GIs. These multiple rocket launchers were the deadliest effective indirect fire weapons in the German arsenal. The German 88 gun was the most famous weapon of World War II, and it appeared in a series of forms, ranging as an anti-aircraft gun, for which it was initially invented. It appeared as an anti-tank gun. It appeared as a tank gun mounted on a Tiger II tank. And although the 88 gun gained its formidable operation as an anti-tank gun, its origins were as an anti-aircraft gun. But the Germans used it on the ground in violation of the Geneva Convention. Included in the strategy to seize the Meuse River bridges before they could be destroyed by the retreating Americans, Hitler devised two special operations, Operation Hawk and Operation Candor. Their purpose was to spread confusion in the American rear by sabotage. Operation Hawk called for a brigade of paratroopers to be dropped deep within U.S. lines to seize the bridges over the Meuse River and to prevent the Americans from reinforcing their front. To confuse the Americans, a drop of dummy parachutists preceded the real one to give the impression that the airdrop was larger than it was. The operation was checked by American forces a few miles from the Meuse River, and when the German colonel assembled his men, he found that the number was far too small to hold any of the bridges, and he ordered his paratroopers units to make their way back to the German lines, where many were captured and many were executed. Operation Hawk was an unqualified military failure. The German colonel, when he asked his command where the American fuel reserves were located, he was told, "You will soon find out." And the strategy, Hitler's strategy, was based on the premise that the Germans would capture large American fuel dumps. Here is a vast American fuel dump, more than 400,000 5-gallon jerry cans of gasoline, lining 5 miles of roadway, which were assembled in preparation for the Rhine campaign. And here are the remains of a gasoline dump after American troops set fire to it by retreating units. And when the colonel complained to his SS commander that the wooded terrain, the weather conditions, made Operation Hawk a doomed mission, he was told Hitler's orders were unalterable. Operation Candor was planned to infiltrate behind American lines before the arrival of the main Panzer armies to conduct reconnaissance and such diversionary activity as spreading rumors, destroying bridges, misdirecting traffic by switching road signs, and cutting communication lines. And Hitler appointed his favorite commando, Lieutenant Colonel Otto Skorzeny, who was ordered to assemble a special deception panzer brigade of English-speaking German troops wearing American uniforms and carrying false identification papers. But only about a dozen German soldiers were found who had a colloquial American English and a knowledge of slang who could pass as Americans, and another 300 who spoke passable English with an American accent. The commandos were given intense English language training. They were taught how to chew gum in the American manner and to cuss with American gestures, and the best of them were formed into an elite commando unit. The Deception Panzer Brigade comprised about 2,500 men and a dozen captured Sherman tanks. This lead camouflaged Panther of Scorzani's brigade hit a mine, and later two GIs showed the tank's phony American star painted on it. About 150 volunteers with a better knowledge of American English were also organized into Jeep teams to serve as demolition squads, issue false orders, and rearrange road signs. GIs were also warned to challenge any suspicious soldiers they encountered in the forest by asking them questions about U.S. sports, like who won the 1944 Rose Bowl game, or questions about Hollywood, like what was the name of Mickey Mouse's girlfriend, or trivia questions which would be known only by someone living in the United States, like what is the hometown of Little Abner. With Operation Candor, 500,000 GIs were forced to play cat and mouse with each other each time they met on the road. And among the incidents involving Scorzani's Deception Panzer Brigade, Brigadier General Bruce Clark was arrested near St. Vith by an MP who was told to watch out for a Kraut posing as a one-star general. And when he asked Clark about the Chicago Cubs, the general assigned them to the American League, to which the MP replied, "Only a Kraut would make a mistake like that." General Bradley himself was detained by an MP who did not accept Springfield as the capital of Illinois. He was sure it was Chicago. And at another stop, Bradley was asked to name Betty Grable's latest husband, and he drew a blank. But the MP let him pass through when he answered the backup question, "Who is the starting shortstop for the Cleveland Indians?" And many of these commandos, these Yankee Germans, were executed as spies. Here is a German commando wearing a double uniform. On the afternoon of the first day of the defensive, December 16, Scorzani's Panzer Brigade was bogged down in the massive traffic jams on the narrow roads, which also hindered the panzers, and many of which fell into ditches and were unable to maneuver. Scorzani realized that Operation Candor was unable to carry out its mission by moving ahead of the panzer divisions, and he was then authorized to reconstitute his brigade as a regular combat to capture the crossroads town of Malmedy, which had been bypassed by the Germans. As an infantry sergeant of the 30th Division, I challenged a lone, suspicious-looking character near the village of Stavlo, just north of Malmedy, to give the password, but he mumbled, reached for his weapon, which I shot out of his hand. He was wearing a double uniform, an American over a German one. I sent him to the rear to be bandaged, where he was interrogated and executed as a spy. And a number of these Yankee Germans were executed as spies. The Belgian town of Malmedy The German town of Malmedy in the center of the toward the north of the bulge was the scene of the infamous execution of American POWs one day after the beginning of the German offensive. On December 17, the Germans machine gunned GI prisoners at a crossroads near Malmedy, and the lead unit of the 1st SS Panzer Division, which was commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Joachim Piper. He was a former adjutant of Heinrich Himmler. Piper's objective was to open a gap in the American line through which to lead his 117 tanks, his armored personnel carriers, his artillery pieces and anti-aircraft guns before the arrival of the main panzer armies. And this red army, this red line, indicates Piper's task force. But his troops were cut off by the U.S. 30th Division and the 82nd Airborne Division and supporting units for 3 days. But they had to then pull back. The Americans had to pull back to this fortified goose egg, where, however, they were threatened with entrapment, and they had to move westward to withdraw through the lines of the 82nd Airborne. By the second day of the offensive, Piper was already 12 hours behind schedule, having run into determined opposition from American small unit arms. And when confronted by Piper's lead unit at a crossroads, members of the U.S. 86th Engineer Battalion sought cover in ditches like these along the road. The Germans fired machine guns into the ditches, forcing the Americans to surrender. About 113 POWs were assembled in a field near a cafe at the crossroads, and for unexplained reason, some tried to escape, like this GI, but he didn't make it. For unexplained reasons, the Germans opened fire on the GI prisoners who were closely massed in the field, and those who were still alive were shot at close range. The bodies of the American soldiers lay snowbound, buried and frozen in a no man's land until January the 4th, 1945, when they were found by units of the 30th Infantry Division after the German retreat from the area. And the bodies were discovered by mine detectors. Autopsies on the bodies revealed, quote, terrible and unusual fatal injuries were administered to the victims at close range, unquote. And here, U.S. soldiers lie by their anti-tank gun, shot by Piper's Panzer Brigade in an unequal battle. And here, German soldiers loot American corpses and note that the GIs are barefoot. Both the geography, the weather, and the terrain was ill-suited to the movement of fuel-guzzling tanks, which required infantry and artillery to support them, and both of these were inadequate on both sides, both the American and the German side. The advanced unit of Dietrich's 6th Panzer Army were halted not only by the U.S. defense of the major approaches to the key town of St. Vith in the north, but also by the congested roads and by the German fuel shortage. So, blocked in the northern sector of the Bulge, the battle then and the battle for the St. Vith salient, German activity then shifted to the center front of the Bulge around Bastogne, which was commanded by von Manteuffel's 5th Panzer Army. Once the Allies overcame their surprise and realized the seriousness of the German threat, General Eisenhower called up 4 veteran divisions, which were in reserve for rest and rehabilitation in France during the Christmas period. He called up the 82nd and the 101st Airborne Divisions and the 28th and 30th Infantry Divisions. The 101st Airborne was an elite, all-volunteer outfit whose paratroopers were known as the Screaming Eagles. Their commander was Maxwell Taylor, but who was in Washington at the time, and the acting CO was Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe, here with General Patton. During the night of December 18, the entire division was transported by hundreds of 2.5-ton trucks from its R&R base in France to Bastogne in Belgium. Belgium at the time was serving as headquarters of the U.S. 8th Corps, which was preparing plans for the coming invasion of Germany. The 8th Corps had to move out of the town as the 101st moved into the town, thereby causing a monumental traffic jam. The invading Germans also have their traffic problems. When Commanding General Fritz Bayerlein, who was an old Africa Corps officer, asked Belgian civilians which road led to Bastogne, they directed him down the wrong road. Here is an aerial view of Bastogne showing the spider web of roads that converged on the town. And here the civilians are fleeing west to avoid the fighting. Civilians in Belgium suffered tremendous deprivations during the winter. When the fog lifted about 10:30 a.m. on December 18, the small American units, which were the remains of the German offensive in the villages east and north of Bastogne, the Americans opened fire, but the Germans threw in heavy artillery, forcing the Americans to pull back toward Bastogne, during which many were captured and many were killed. General Eisenhower and his senior commanders realized that the German offensive was much more serious than expected, much more serious than anticipated. As village after village fell to the Germans, it was clear that Bastogne would be surrendered. But when the Germans failed to take the town, they bypassed it and resumed their drive to the Meuse River. To stop the German offensive, Eisenhower needed Patton's Third Army, which was geared up to attack eastward into the valley of the Saar River. And in order to shift his army toward Bastogne, Patton would have to make a 90-degree turn to the north from the east, over more than 100 miles of icy roads with 100,000 men and tens of thousands of vehicles. Patton's Third Army came to a halt here in the Saar Valley, stalled by the Siegfried Line. At this time, the Western Front was virtually stabilized, and the only activity was in the overcast air with the overflight of German buzz bombs, which were launched nightly against targets in England and at Antwerp, as well as across the Channel at other English targets. These buzz bombs are known as the V2s, and the V in V2 stands for the German word vengeance weapon. This is the weapon that Hitler planned to win the battle. The V-2 is the first long-range ballistic missile developed for warfare. It packed a 2,200-pound warhead and a range of 200 miles. The V-2, however, was an almost total failure as a military weapon, but the V-2 represented the dawn of the intercontinental ballistic missile. And it was much more effective psychologically than physically because we didn't know where it was. We did not hear it coming. No one heard them coming because the guidance system wasn't accurate. Many of them fell not only into the sea, but many of them fell on the battlefront. Some of these crude early missiles, some of these bombs, fell far short of their targets. In fact, one V-2 exploded on Christmas Day in 1944 on the American Field Hospital in Liège. It shattered the roof and the building, which fell on GIs like myself who were under treatment for their battle wounds, resulting in fresh wounds for which we received another Purple Heart. Patton was then ordered to swivel his Third Army 90 degrees from east to north. And when a British liaison officer asked Patton if he had any message to send to Field Marshal Montgomery, Patton glared at the man and replied, "You tell Montgomery that the Third Army is attacking north and for him to get out of the way because I'm going to run the German army up his ass." Here are GIs in the defense of Bastogne. On December the 22nd, McAuliffe received word of Patton's drive from the south and the promise of a supply airdrop as soon as the weather cleared. At 11:30 a.m., two Germans arrived at his Bastogne headquarters under a flag with a surrender offer. It was a type message demanding, quote, the honorable surrender of the encircled town of Bastogne, unquote, and gave the Americans 2 hours to reply. And when Caulif asked his aide, what does it say, Ned? The aide answered, they want you to surrender. Nuts, the general barked. Well, I don't know what to tell them, he added. One of his officers replied, the first crack of yours would be pretty hard to beat. What was that, the general asked. You said nuts. So a laconic reply was sent to the German commander, nuts, signed the American commander. And when the reply reached the German commander, he asked, was ist das nuts? The battle raged all around the perimeter of Bastogne as German tanks and infantry pounded the besieged Americans and attacked the roadblocks leading to the town. But the defense held, and McAuliffe's artillery smashed attack after attack until the arrival of American air power and Patton's units. On December the 26th, the weather cleared, and U.S. gliders landed west of Bastogne with nurses and doctors. And in the afternoon, Patton's advance units arrived on the road leading to Bastogne. And when McAuliffe met the officer of the first unit to reach the town, he greeted the captain with his laconic reply, gee, I am mighty glad to see you. The defense of Bastogne has become the stuff of legend, but it was the series of unsung minor battles to protect the crossroads leading to the town which made the defense possible, because without these little battles by small infantry and artillery units with GIs carrying weapons like the M1 and the heavy losses which they incurred, there would have been no Bastogne to defend. And the same scenario applies to the defense of St. Vith in the northern sector of the Bulge. By Christmas 1944, the Germans lost their offensive drive on both the northern and central sectors of the front, and by this time the outcome was clear. It was not a matter of the defeat of the German Ardennes offensive, but when and how long it would take. And by January 25, 1945, the Allies reached the frontier of Germany and the battle was erased. The Bulge was erased. Among what the Germans left behind were a number of graffiti. This one reads, the Führer gives us orders, we will obey, a graffito by a zealous SS Hitler youth. This slogan reads, victory at any cost. And this one reads, the dream is over, which is a fitting comment of Hitler's Ardennes offensive. Many books and articles have been written about the execution of American POWs at Malmedy on December 17. Colonel Piper and 70 members of his army group were found guilty because they did, quote, willfully, deliberately, and wrongfully permit, encourage, aid, abet, and participate in the killing, shooting, ill-treatment, abuse, and torture of Americans of the armed forces of the United States of America. He and his supporters and top lieutenants were sentenced to death by hanging, but the sentence was never carried out. Military historians, however, conclude that it was the rush to judgment at the Dachau trial which resulted in incomplete and inadequate or flawed evidence which assured that guilty men would escape proper punishment. Under what circumstances were the American POWs executed, and who was responsible for it? No acceptable evidence was presented at the trial of a premeditated execution. As an infantry sergeant of the 30th Division, I was told by my company captain that American POWs were executed at close range with their hands tied behind their back and that they were barefoot. He added that no prisoners were to be taken alive in retaliation for the executions. And as the company moved past the crossroads, I saw evidence of mass bodies slightly covered by the falling snow, GIs frozen and barefoot. 65 years later, it seems impossible to affirm or deny what happened at Malmedy. Military historians, however, accept as fact that American POWs were executed at Malmedy on December 17. And this Belgian memorial at the Crossroads Cemetery bears the names of 84 American soldiers, and the U.S. Eagle watches over them. Among the many reasons for the failure of Hitler's Ardennes offensive were these: the failure of German tactical and logistic support to keep up with the spearhead units, the chronic lack of German fuel supply, the failure of the Panzers to maintain their initial momentum, which was hampered by both the terrain and the weather, especially around the key salients of St. Vith and Bastogne. The speed of U.S. small unit tactical response and the rapid commitment of American reserves, both of which surprised the Germans. But above all, it was the dogged American defense which was greater than the Germans expected. After the end of the war in Europe, May 1945, an American GI wrote this analysis of the Battle of the Bulge from the point of view of the enlisted man. The Battle of the Bulge was one of the hardest, if not the hardest, fight of the Allied armies in Europe. The weather, the terrain, and the enemy combined to make a campaign of peculiar bitterness and difficulty. And when the enemy was finally forced back, by far, the largest credit must go to the men who shouldered rifles and carried machine guns, BARs, bazookas, mortars in freezing weather, who plunged through knee-deep and waist-high snow, who dug foxholes in ground as hard as steel, and who cleared out woods as dark as night in the middle of the day. For both the Americans and the Germans, the cost of the Battle of the Bulge was very high. 600,000 American troops were engaged in the battle, of which there were over 81,000 casualties, and this included 20,000 killed in action, 40,000 wounded, and 23,500 captured or missing. For the Germans, 30,000 were killed in action, 40,000 wounded, 40,000 POWs, and thousands of tanks and vehicles destroyed. The Battle of the Bulge was the biggest battle ever fought by the U.S. Army. It was the largest and bloodiest American land battle of World War II, and it remains the costliest battle in all American military history. And this image, and then the weather and the German army tested the American soldiers in the battle to their maximum psychological and physical endurance. And this image exemplifies the battle in very simple terms. Here is a medic who drags a wounded GI strapped to a stretcher set on runners toward an aid station across a snowy battlefield. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the story of the Battle of the Bulge as I experienced it as a soldier And I researched it as a military historian.
Remind our audience online that we're listening to Andrew Jamison, a military historian and former vice chancellor of UC Berkeley, speaking about the Battle of the Bulge in which he took part. Now it's time for questions from the audience. Who'd like to ask the first question?
Isn't it true that the Germans used some clever devices, like they parachuted some English-speaking soldiers behind the American lines with MP bands to misdirect traffic behind the American lines?
Absolutely. That's part of Piper's Deception Brigade. And we caught a lot of those people, and we executed them as spies. But they did a lot of damage because, as I said, for the period of the Deception Brigade, Americans were told to watch out for anybody behind any tree and to ask for the password. And if they didn't get it, to shoot, because we didn't know who, because the Germans were wearing American uniforms over German uniforms. And the German lawyers told the Germans before they began the battle that they would be okay if they were able to remove their American uniform before they were caught. Well, that's a lot of nonsense. They didn't have time to do that. We shot them.
During the battle, did you have the feeling that the war would end in 4 months?
That the war would end in 4 months?
The battle.
No, at the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge, we thought that the Germans would probably reach the French border. We thought that. And most of our reserves were in France. Unfortunately, so were our overcoats. It was cold as hell. We had no overcoats because they were on the ships coming to France, to the continent, because the command did not expect. Bradley did not. In fact, Bradley said the Germans couldn't possibly come through the Ardennes. But they did. At the beginning, we thought it would be a very long battle. But with the speed of the American reserves which were brought into play, especially those reserves which were in France during the Christmas vacation, they were brought immediately, overnight, and the spectacle of thousands and thousands of 2.5-ton trucks carrying entire divisions across France to Belgium, that made it possible for a shorter battle. And it was quite clear that by that time the German offensive had failed. Hitler needed the reason for the Ardennes offensive is because Hitler needed a victory someplace, either in Germany, the West or in Russia. And he couldn't get one in Russia. He was sure he couldn't get it in the West against the Americans and the British, against the Allies. And what he counted on was these magnificent weapons that after the war we brought their German scientists to the United States, Brown, for example, to create the interballistic missiles. And the V-2, which was this very early buzz bomb, which fell not on its targets, it hit Coventry, remember, it hit parts of London. That weapon is really the forerunner of the modern ballistic missiles. And Hitler counted especially on the technology of that weapon to help him in the war.
Professor, what would have happened if the air power hadn't opened up?
I understand that there wasn't clearing over that area for many, many weeks, and that in the end, when the air power opened up, it allowed us to, the Air Force, to come in and support that area.
Yes.
By the way, the doodle bugs were a pain.
Yeah, the question was, what would have happened if the air power had not, if the air overhead, if the weather hadn't opened up? So the air
power would have been a quick battle. But you see, Hitler knew the weather conditions. And for an entire week, the fog was almost on the ground. And we prayed on the ground for that weather to clear.
In December of 1944, the 84th Infantry Division was newly arrived in Europe and was assigned a spot in the Ardennes region. After the Battle of the Bulge, I've never been able to find out anything about the division. Was it ever reconstituted? Did it have casualties? Do you know anything about the 84th?
No, I don't, but I can find out for you. I have a very large library on the Battle of the Bulge and its aftermath. Many of those troops, we crossed the Rhine. Many of the units that I've mentioned were in the crossing of the Rhine. And the problem then was to get to Berlin as quickly as we can. Unfortunately, the American president made an agreement that we would stop on the Elbe River. We could have gone to Berlin much quicker than the Russians ever thought of getting there. But we stopped there. But your unit, I could certainly find out what happened to it. No units were abandoned. And it is one of the many units which participated in the Battle of the Bulge. There are about 10 armored divisions. There are about 14 infantry divisions, 5 air commands. All of these participated in the Battle of the Bulge. So I can find that out. It's the 84th.
Dr. Jameson, you shared with us how you got the second Purple Heart. Would you be willing to tell us more about the first Purple Heart?
Which hurt more?
Boy, the command decided, you know, in the battle, tanks do not advance without the support of the infantry to protect them. When I found that out, I was really appalled. So the command decided to put units of infantry squads on the back of a tank. And then the battle begins. What they disregarded was that if the troops were in the back of a tank, the turret is going to turn. And when the tank started, I had 5 men and myself on the back of that tank. The tank began to move. The German machine guns were on both sides firing at the tank. We were exposed to that machine gun fire. Well, what do? I told these guys to jump. Some of them wouldn't jump. I kicked them off that tank. 2 of them broke their legs. Better to have a broken leg than have a machine gun fire cutting you in half. And then when I jumped, I got hit. And that's the Purple Heart.
Just to make one thing clear, in case anyone's wondering, the M1 rifle that Dr. Jameson has is not a working model.
thanks to my friend here, Krauss.
Professor, after the massacre at Malmedy, were there any instances where U.S. troops massacred German prisoners of war? And you talk about the spies, you know, and we killed them because they had uniforms on that were our uniforms, et cetera. But were there any instances in this battle where U.S. troops killed German prisoners in retaliation for this Malmedy massacre?
Not in the same sense as the Germans executed the Americans. We executed a number of Germans as spies who were found wandering in the forests. We executed them as spies because they had no unit. But we did not do, in the grand sense that you referred to, the execution of the Germans in that same sense. Many were executed because they were spies wearing double uniforms. And also, a wonderful incident, the Germans started a brigade of jeeps, and they put four men on the jeep. Well, this was a giveaway to the Americans. The Germans didn't realize that we had so many jeeps in the American armies that we never put four on a jeep, no more than two. And when a jeep with four men was caught, they announced, "We are part of a brigade." Well, that was a giveaway, and they were executed. There were things like that that occurred.
All right, well, there's time for maybe two or three more questions. Who else has a question?
I wish my brother were here to hear your story. We buried him in a veteran cemetery last year in Michigan. He had a very good civilian life, family, successful in business. He was also was a 19-year-old sergeant who was in that battle or in a battle near there. And he had the misfortune of being captured and spent the better part, or I guess I should say the worst part of a year, as Hitler's guest in Stalag 3C. Eventually escaped, made his way to Russia, to Egypt, and then back home. He had interesting experiences, but he never talked about them.
No, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, veterans of World War II have kept silent for over 60 years and never talked.
And even years later, he occasionally would have a PSPS, a kind of a flashback.
Right. But they're beginning to talk now. And one movie which was very, very disturbing to GIs of World War II was Saving Private Ryan. The first shots of that movie was very, very realistic. And I watched it with three veterans. Two of them fainted when they watched that movie. A very realistic view of what happened when GIs landed in Normandy, when the landing craft could not get close to the shore. The back went out. The GIs were forced to get out of the landing craft. 7 feet of water. They were carrying 70 pounds of material. The Germans were shooting mortars at them, and that was very vividly described and depicted in Saving Private Ryan.
And my father and five of his brothers were all in the war, and one of them was in Patton's Third Army. My father was dropped off in North Africa, and he went all the way through the war and landed in southern France with the same thing, and he said that they were being fired on D-Day. And the Navy guy wouldn't go closer, and they had to put a gun to his head and say, "You have to bring us closer or we'll all die in the water."
Right.
So that also took place a lot. And it's just, also, my father never would talk about it either. The only time he talked about it was during the discussions about the Vietnam War.
But we're beginning to talk about it.
Yeah. So
and
one
now
more.
What we should have now is the publication of much oral history from veterans, but unfortunately, there aren't that many left. About 1,000 veterans of World War II are dying every day. So in time, there'll be very few of veterans of World War II.
And the last question, we'll get to the other veteran.
Yes, I was a GI during the Battle of the Bulge. It's my impression, I'm wondering whether you agree, that the German small arms, except for the rifle, were superior to those of the American. I'm thinking particularly of the machine gun, which had a cyclic rate of fire of about twice the speed of the American. It was some brrrr, brrrr, brrrr versus bup, 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 bup. And do you agree?
Absolutely. In fact, I would make a general statement. The German armory was far superior to the American. We know that the German tanks were superior to ours. And it wasn't the quality of the tank which made a difference, but rather the quantity. The Germans didn't have enough of them. Hitler had to maneuver and bring many tanks from the Russian front to the Western front. So I would agree with you, the German armaments were superior to those of the Americans. But my baby here is still mine.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Jameson. Not a better example of living history. So that ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.